It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, how big a problem are things like climate change, the federal budget deficit, race relations, and the economy? A new survey from UW-Madison asked Wisconsin residents about those and other issues. We'll find out what they had to say. First, we often hear elected officials and political analysts blame tribalism for stark division in the United States. The idea is we pick a side, a team, we dig in too far, and it becomes a case of us versus them. But our next guest says it doesn't have to be that way, and that our group identities can actually help us get along with others, even outside our own groups, if we do it right. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like the country's more divided than you've ever seen in your life? Why or why not? Do you think it comes from particular groups or the way we buy in, the way we pick sides, pick teams? What do you think can work to bridge those divisions? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dominic Packer is a psychology professor at Lehigh University and co-author of the book, The Power of Us, Harnessing Our Shared Identities to Improve Performance, Increase Cooperation, and Promote Social Harmony. He wrote a piece for The Atlantic with his co-author called The Myth of Tribalism. Dominic, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me today.
Well, we sometimes hear this term tribalism thrown around a lot these days, I think, in American politics in particular. Can you offer us more of a definition of what people, of how people are using it?
Yeah, I think when people use the word tribalism, they're trying to reach for a sense of the toxicity of that group relations can turn into. And I think as we look out at our political landscape, there clearly are toxic relations both between groups, right? A lot of vitriolic language and dislike and unwillingness to compromise, and also some problematic dynamics even within groups, sort of intolerance of dissent and internal critique and people who might raise alternative ideas, especially if they're too much like the other side. And so when people use the word polarization, they're trying to capture that general sense that things have somehow gone off the rails. And although it's a good word to describe that, we don't think it's inevitable.
We'll get into that. I want to get to some of the basics of human group identity, though. It's a super natural thing for us to identify with a particular group of people or many different groups of people. Can you talk about that as a sort of fundamental bit of our humanity?
That's right. So we argue that human beings are fundamentally groupish, that if there's something built in and innate, it's not necessarily a tribal kind of instinct, and especially that sort of toxic group dynamic that I was talking about before. But certainly we have a strong propensity to identify with groups, so much so that you can put people in completely novel groups and they'll immediately feel some sort of allegiance to them. So there's these famous experiments from the 1970s that have informed a lot of the work that we do called the minimal group experiments, which essentially put people randomly into a group they've never heard of before, a team A or a team B, or we've often used the lions and the tigers. And as soon as you're part of that category, although you know nobody in that group, you're never going to interact with people in the group, it nevertheless starts to feel important to you. And when given the chance to, say, divide resources between your group and another group, people will tend to give more to their own team that, again, they'd never heard of even 5 minutes before. So there's certainly this readiness to identify with groups, and it comes on very quickly and strongly.
Well, I want to talk about a group you identify with, one you have with your co-author. You share a story in your book, one of you, a small town hockey playing kid, the other kind of a big city type, but skeptical of each other at first, brought together by a piece of cheese. Could you tell us a little bit about that story?
Right. So we met at graduate school at the University of Toronto and initially didn't get along that well, in part because my collaborator, Jay, moved from a small town in Alberta where he had lots of room into a tiny apartment in the middle of Toronto with no place to store his goalie equipment. So he decided to bring it into our shared office. And anyone who's played hockey or been around hockey players knows that that's smelly stuff. And it's a sub-basement office with no ventilation. So we weren't necessarily get us off on the right foot. But shortly thereafter, the department had an event, and afterwards there was a wine and cheese. And as we were in conversation with a group of people, Jay choked. This piece of cheese lodged in his throat and he couldn't breathe. And it took me a while to figure out what was going on. Initially, the bartender tried to give him the Heimlich and it actually dislodged. And then Jay grabbed me and dragged me to the bathroom opposite the reception room. And I figured out what was happening and I gave him the Heimlich, and eventually the cheese popped out and rolled across the floor. And I was horrified. I wanted to go home and collapse. And Jay thought it was hilarious and wanted to go and eat more cheese. But the stress of that moment sort of brought us together in a funny kind of way. And after that, we started talking to each other more and getting more interested in each other's ideas. And ultimately, we've now worked together for more than 15 years.
And I wanted to ask about that story, A, because there's cheese in it and we're in Wisconsin, but B, it's a very small scale example of a way that you were divided initially by a couple of your group identities. A unique shared experience brought you together. There could be lessons here, right?
Absolutely. So one of the things that can bring people together, in this case as a dyad, but in groups more generally, are adverse circumstances. We argue in our book that circumstances can often conspire to create a sense of solidarity. And sometimes these are good things that are happening, but sometimes they're bad things. In this particular example, right, choking on cheese is a pretty traumatic kind of event. But we see again and again, for example, during times of crisis, whether it's a natural disaster, some sort of terrorist attack, or even potentially a global pandemic, that in response to this common challenge, people can respond by recognizing they have common goals and that by working together, they can achieve those goals more effectively than they could on their own. And so it becomes a source of solidarity in moments of crisis.
Talking to psychology professor Dominic Packer, co-author of the book, The Power of Us. He co-wrote a piece for The Atlantic called The Myth of Tribalism, looking at our group identity, how it can divide us, but how it can bring us together, too. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Dominic, let's get into this tribalism idea now. What is it that determines if I'm in a group and I identify with it so strongly that it turns into a negative thing toward other people versus, I don't know, our shared values within that group that help us get along with people even outside that group?
That's right. So what we argue, and this is based on extensive research, both ours and other people's, is that when you identify with a group, that's almost like the fuel that drives your activity. It's propelling you to want to do things that you see as good for the group and pursue the group's goals. But what those activities are, what that behavior is very much determined by the norms of the group. And the norms set the direction. So it's like the identity is the fuel and the norms are the direction. And group norms can take all kinds of forms. They can certainly be toxic and insular and parochial and discriminatory. They can be anti-dissent. On the other hand, they can be open and warm and inclusive, both internally, seeking out criticism and enjoying and celebrating people who raise alternate ideas, but also even, you know, being helpful outside your group, and in some cases, in extreme cases, perhaps of charitable organizations, in some cases, doing more good outside the group than they would do internally. And so it's what the norms are that really shape people's behaviors. And for that reason, I think it's really important to get people thinking about group norms and not just the degree to which they identify.
Okay, so if I'm in a group, call it Team Republican or Team Democrat, say, and I feel like, yes, I believe in the principles that I share with this group, and I'm going to vote and I'm going to work for my team, but I'm worried that my team, my party, is getting too confrontational. It's not willing to follow the rules anymore. That worries me. That's betraying why I got into this. How can I start to try to change that or to bring back even that shared value?
I mean, that's the central question, or one of the central questions of the time we live in, I think. I mean, first of all, I think it's important to recognize what these dynamics are, which is one of the reasons we wrote this book, is helping people to see how powerful these group norms can be in shaping how we see the world and what we think is appropriate. And then to recognize that, well, maybe they're not necessarily always the best thing, and not necessarily in just an objective sense, but maybe they're not best thing for us, right? That for our group, this is having some negative consequences. And if you can get people to think about that, how is the way we're behaving counterproductive to our own long-term interests or to our sense of our own ethics or values, they can start to question those kinds of behaviors. So that's, I think, an important step, is to reflect on your own responses and behaviors and think how you might like to do things differently. And the other, I think, is to at least partially recognize the incentive structures, especially in online kind of social media environments, where people are being rewarded for incredibly divisive and incendiary kinds of rhetoric. And often it feels good when you see someone sort of hammering the other side and you see them insulting, and And so you give it a like or you give it a retweet. It's sort of like, yeah, let's go. What we would encourage people to do is take a step back from that. Again, if you don't like those norms, and a lot of people say they don't like how toxic it's become, then we need to stop rewarding it. Because the people who do this, the pundits and the politicians who engage in this sort of, overinflated inflammatory rhetoric, are responsive to incentives. They're doing it because it gets attention and because it gets rewarded by being spread widely.
We're talking with Lehigh University psychology professor Dominic Packer about social and political divisions, how to bridge them, and what he calls the myth of tribalism. He's co-author of the book, The Power of Us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a social group, a political group you feel like you identify with? Are there lots of them? And sometimes they might lead you in different directions. Do you think we have gotten too divided, especially politically, maybe socially in this country? What kind of things do you think would work to bridge those divides? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about tribalism with Dominic Packer. He co-wrote a new book called The Power of Us and a piece in The Atlantic on the myth of tribalism, looking at the ways that our group identities can bring us together instead of pulling us apart. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think we can or should become less divided as a society? Are you hopeful we could start to become a little more reunited? How would you like to see social groups held accountable when they engage in divisive behavior? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I don't really like the two-side narrative because, you know, there's 300 million people in the United States. People are different. We have, and then the other thing about that is that it's the divisive because it puts you into two sides, which I don't think it really should be. And then the internet allows people to say things that they would never say in person. So I think it's almost like anti-social media because people don't usually behave in the manner that they behave on the internet. And also, I remember the Pledge of Allegiance, you know, indivisible. And on our money, it says our motto, E Pluribus Unum. Out of many, one. And this is the idea that needs to be, you know, we're communities. We're not like sides. You know, we're not, I think that's just being used by politicians for power and influence.
Willem, thanks a lot for the call. Willem, Dominic gave us a lot to work with there. Where do you want to start?
I think Willem makes really great points. Sometimes the way political scientists talk about polarization is actually a useful way to think about it, I think. They describe polarized societies as societies where there's been a flattening of identity. You take a society where people have all sorts of different parts of themselves and they crisscross in ways that are not perfectly overlapping. So you have religious affiliations and there's where you live and there's your occupational identity and then there's your political beliefs. And they're all partially overlapping, but you're also part of different groups with different people who think differently from you. And that's a healthy way for society to be. It's also an exciting way to live. What happens with extreme polarization is all of that diversity of identity gets flattened into a single dimension so that everybody is essentially now being defined by where they fall on one spectrum from left to right. And it doesn't feel good and it's quite boring and it's certainly not healthy for societies. And so I think the point Lone's making is that a lot of people don't want that. They don't want to be flattened into that single sort of dimension. And we should be helping people recover aspects of themselves and bring other aspects of themselves to interactions with each other.
And it seems like you could do that, Dominic, on social media. But the opposite happens, as Willem points out. If you are in a political debate with someone online, it's really easy to collapse their identity and your own identity into that one dimension, that one side.
Absolutely. So we argue in our book that social media certainly didn't create polarization, but that it's acted as an accelerant. That if you introduce social media platforms into a society that's already struggling with this sort of issue, it tends to make things worse. And my collaborator, Jay at NYU, has done amazing work looking at the dynamics of interactions on social media platforms, and especially what sort of content in a tweet or a Facebook post tends to go viral. And what they find is that the content that's much more likely to be shared contains words that they describe as moral emotional, So they're not just moral words like good or bad. They're words like disgust or hate. There's these strong moralistic connotations and a ton of emotional content. And then if you pair that with a mention of the political outgroup, it's even more likely to go viral. And so this is the stuff that spreads online. And again, that incentivizes people who want to get attention, politicians and pundits in particular, to use that sort of language because it gets picked up and it gets shared in ways that have these pretty negative consequences overall.
Thanks for that call, Willem, at 800-642-1234. Mitch joins us next in Milwaukee. Mitch, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Mitch?
I just wanted to bring up, I think that if we focused our education on teaching morals, ethics, and logic, we'd be much better off as a society than we are today.
And are you thinking, like, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, Kantism specifically, like Kant. Moral philosophy.
Mitch, thanks for the call. Mitch thinks some early education in ethics and philosophy could help us out. What do you think, Dominic?
I think it couldn't hurt. One of the things we would argue in the book is that behavior is, because it's shaped by our identities, and we all have multiple identities, and they can come in and out of focus at different times, it's important to take that into account when we're thinking about ethics, because somebody who might live ethically and by a certain set of standards in much of their lives could still find themselves in a situation where they're part of a group with a very strong pattern of norms that would actually lead them away from that. And it's important to recognize that that can happen and to put it on pause and say, okay, I don't want to go down that road. I don't like these norms. I need to leave this group, or I need to try and change how this group is behaving.
Thanks for that call, Mitch, at 800-642-1234. Dominic, something that struck me in your book and that I've heard elsewhere sometimes is our perception of how divided we are. We hear from the most polarized people on social media and in the news sometimes, and looking at it through that lens, it might seem like everybody is at each other's throats. Everybody is leaping to one side or the other of the divide. But there's a lot of people out there who aren't so front and center. Do we need to focus more on them to get a better picture?
I think so. I think that a distorted picture, an over-exaggerated picture of polarization in some ways makes it worse. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's an important distinction between different kinds of polarization. One is called affective or emotional polarization. And I think there's little doubt that we are living through a peak of that kind of dynamic right now, that people feel a lot of negativity toward the other side. And in that sense, we are very polarized. But there's another kind of polarization, which is called issue or ideological polarization, which is much more about what do we actually think about real issues? Where do we stand on tax policy and how healthcare should work? Even something like gun control, which is very contested. And what you find in the American population is that when you actually drill down into real policy issues, there's way more agreement than people think there is. The left and the right actually tend to be pretty much aligned on a whole bunch of things where if only we could get past this emotional reaction, we could actually find some compromise. There's definitely room there to compromise. But if you don't see it, then you don't have those interactions. You don't have those conversations, and we don't actually move anything forward.
Talking to Dominic Packer, psychology professor, co-author of the book, The Power of Us, looking at a divided America, polarization, and how to overcome it. Let's go now to Jack in Viola. Jack, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. The issue I see, it's really nice to say, okay, let's all do us together. I mean, I really support that psychology. But when I've listened and seen a lot of things, it comes down to two principles. One is a zero-sum approach or strategy, and the other one is a win-win. And it seems this culture is really struck on that because, the win-win type of thing is the optimal strategy. The win-lose is a zero-sum strategy. And there are people who believe that, you know, their right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, you know, well, if it comes at your cost, it comes at your cost.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Dominic, I know this is something that psychologists and political researchers think about a lot. What do you have to say to Jack?
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. I think if you see problems as inherently zero sum, we're competing over a resource, and if we win, you lose, and if you win, we lose, then it's very hard to reach compromise. And that if we can reframe problems to be one so that we have to find a solution where we all gain somehow, there's some greater collective benefit, then that is a path forward. And I'll give a plug just very quickly for somebody else's book called How Rights Went Wrong, Why Our Obsession with Rights is Tearing America Apart by Jamal Green, there's a really interesting case to make about how the conception of rights as being zero sum, if I have a right, then you don't have a right, is part of the toxic dynamic in American politics, and that rethinking how we think about even something as fundamental as rights can help us reach that more win-win kind of approach.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute or so, Dominic, are you hopeful that we can get away from the us versus them, worst case, tribalized identities, and, I don't know, see each other as full people again?
Depends which day you ask me on. I think I'm hopeful that we can certainly do it, but I'm not always optimistic that we will do it quickly or that it'll be easy to do.
What's a step that you would recommend to somebody listening right now to, in their small way, help bridge that gap?
I would say when you're interacting with people online, offer some grace. You know, remember that people are multifaceted and that they probably have aspects of their identities that actually they share with you, even if it's not so visible. That's one thing. And the other is hold politicians and pundits to account. If they're using language you don't like, and many of us say we don't like this toxicity, then don't reward it. Whether it's the other side or your own side, just because it feels good to retweet something that's, you know, slamming the other side, don't retweet it if you don't like these dynamics.
Dominic, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me, Rob.
Dominic Packer is a psychology professor at Lehigh University, co-author of the book, The Power of Us, Harnessing Our Shared Identities to Improve Performance, Increase Cooperation, and Promote Social Harmony. He was with us today talking about social and political divisions and some of the ways we can help bridge them.